This is Jeff Blankford with the February 8th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Do you remember Karl Rove, one of the masterminds of the George Bush years? Sure you do. In October 2004, a year and a half after the start of America's second war in Iraq, he told Ron Suskin, writing for the New York Times Magazine, that, quote, "We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too. And that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do," end quote. Veteran Dutch journalist Carl van Wolferen, who has been closely studying what we do, cited Rove's comment as an illustration of the hubris of the Bush-Cheney government. "But we could also see as a fulfilled prophecy," he wrote last month in an article for UN's Review entitled appropriately, "Karl Rove's Prophecy," fulfilled in a manner that no journalist at that time would have deemed possible. "Yes," wrote von Wolferen, "the neoconservatives brought disrepute upon themselves because of the disaster in Iraq. Sure, opposition to the reality Rove had helped create in that devastated country became a first rung on the ladder that could lead to the presidency as it did for Barack Obama. But as von Wolferen points out, the neocons stayed put in the State Department and other positions closely linked to the Obama White House, where they became allies with the liberal hawks in continuing spreading democracy by overthrowing regimes. America's mainstream news and opinion purveyors, without demurring, accommodated the architects of reality production overseen by Dick Cheney," end quote. That's how Karl von Wolferen began his extremely thought-provoking article in January, as what I will be speaking with him about at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, we'll look at the news and opinion purveyors. While Donald Trump was still huffing and puffing last weekend about the Seattle judge who declared unconstitutional his executive order banning immigrants from seven Muslim countries from entering the United States, millions watching the Super Bowl who tuned in earlier saw a very different pre-recorded version of our newly elected president. Being interviewed by Fox News' Bill Riley, Trump was challenged once again for his past comments praising Russian President Vladimir Putin. "Do you respect Putin?" O'Reilly asked him, and when Trump answered in the affirmative, O'Reilly wanted to know why. "Well," responded Trump, "I respect a lot of people, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him. He's a leader of his country. I say it's better to get along with Russia than not. And if Russia helps us in the fight against ISIS, which is a major fight, that's a good thing. Will I get along with him?" "But he's a killer, though. Putin's a killer," O'Reilly snapped back. "There are a lot of killers," said Trump. "We've got a lot of killers. What do you think, our country's so innocent?" Well, that exchange led the entire editorial board of the New York Times to answer the call to the colors, the very same institution that devoted its pages 14 years ago to backing up the lies of President George W. Bush about Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Quote, "The bromance between President Trump and Vladimir Putin of Russia, long a source of puzzlement and alarm in the West, has gotten even more disturbing," so began the editorial. "This weekend," it continued, "Mr. Trump dismissed a question about why he respected a killer like Mr. Putin by drawing a moral equivalency between the United States and Russia." End quote. Well, that's a very risky statement for the Times to pose to an intelligent reader. When one considers not only the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis killed by the U.S. military in Iraq since 2003 and the effective destruction of that country as well as Libya, and the attack, and add on to that Washington's role in creating ISIS and the jihadists who, in the name of Islam, have been terrorizing the entire region and much of Africa, there is hardly a single country over which the United States can claim moral superiority. But the New York Times obviously cannot see that. Quote, the Times again, "Asserting the moral and political superiority of the United States over Russia has not traditionally been a difficult maneuver for American presidents," the Times tells us. "But rather than endorsing American exceptionalism," it goes on, "Mr. Trump seems to appreciate Mr. Putin's brutality, which includes bombing civilians in Syria and, his accusers allege, responsibility for a trail of dead political opponents and journalists at home, and suggested America acts the same way," end quote. What world is the New York Times editorial board living in that it can employ the jingoistic term American exceptionalism? It obviously is not one in which others in the Times' opinion have the right to judge our actions or bring our war criminals before an international court of law. But it gets worse, incredibly worse for a newspaper considered to be America's quote-unquote paper of record and leading opinion purveyor for the liberal intelligentsia. Goes on. There's no doubt the United States has made terrible mistakes, it admits, like invading Iraq in 2003 and torturing terrorism suspects after September 11th. President Barack Obama, it notes, often drew fire from Republicans for acknowledging the obvious. There are limits to American power, and sometimes decisions to employ military forces have resulted in, quote-unquote, unintended consequences, end quote. American drone strikes against extremists in Afghanistan and Pakistan, for instance, have sometimes killed civilians, end quote. Wrong. Those war crimes, a term the Times refrains from using when the killers are Americans, were no more unintended consequences than were the deaths of the hundreds of thousands of Japanese in the Air Force's firebombing of Tokyo and the atomic bombs it dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or like the Germans who perished under U.S. bombs in Dresden, Hamburg, and Cologne, like the North Vietnamese Hanoi, civilians were the targets. But, contends the New York Times editorial, no American president has done what Mr. Putin has done in silencing nearly all independent media, crushing dissent, snuffing out Russia's once incipient democracy, invading Ukraine, interfering in the American election, apparently on Mr. Trump's behalf, and trying to destabilize Europe. At least in recent decades, it goes on, American presidents who took military action have been driven by the desire to promote freedom and democracy, sometimes with extraordinary results, as when Germany and Japan evolved after World War II from vanquished enemies into trusted, prosperous allies. End quote. Okay, we'll stop there and examine what the Times is telling us and then move on. I'm not an expert on the internal workings of Russia, but even the Times occasionally reports on its dissenters. Having lived, however, through the period of Joe McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee's blacklist and witch hunts, and Harry Truman's launching of the loyalty oaths that became required of all public officials, including school teachers, this country is in no position to lecture any other regarding civil liberties. Moreover, no matter how many Times says it is so, Russia did not invade Ukraine, and there is yet to be produced for the public record a shred of evidence that Russia interfered in our presidential elections. Moreover, I will argue that this charge has been part of a cover-up to make people forget that there was overwhelming evidence that the only interference in the election came from the Democratic National Committee in the successful efforts to sabotage the campaign of Bernie Sanders, who, as polls showed at the time, had a better chance of defeating Trump in November than did Clinton. Listeners should ask themselves and their friends why that is no longer being talked or written about. The Times further insults the intelligence of his readers by stating that, quote, at least in recent decades, American presidents who took military action have been driven by the desire to promote freedom and democracy, end quote. Who will own up to writing such garbage? Does promoting freedom and democracy explain why not only does the U.S. spend more money on weapons of war than the next 10 countries with the highest military budgets combined, but also is the planet's largest weapons seller? Why we have over 1,000 military bases in over 130 countries, Russia has one, and Syria. As Martin Luther King told those assembled in New York's Riverside Church on April 7, 1967, a year to the day before his assassination, when he broke his agreement with Lyndon Johnson not to speak out against the Vietnam War, King said, the United States, quote, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, end quote. What he said was not only true that day, it has been true every day since. While we are looking back at our history, I felt we should remember John Yoo, now a professor at UC Berkeley, but quite a controversial figure under Bush-Cheney administration. Weighing in Monday in an op-ed in What Else, the New York Times, targeting Trump and wrapping himself in the wisdom of Alexander Hamilton, Yoo bragged, quote, as an official in the Justice Department, I followed in Hamilton's footsteps, advising that President George W. Bush could take vigorous, perhaps extreme measures to protect the nation after the September 11th attacks, including invading Afghanistan, opening the Guantanamo Detention Center, and conducting military trials and enhanced interrogation of terrorist leaders. In other words, He is still justifying torture, and that is quite all right, evidently, with the Times opinion page editor. Likewise, you went on, I supported President Barack Obama when he drew on this source of constitutional power for drone attacks and foreign electronic surveillance. But even I have grave concerns by Mr. Trump's use of presidential power, end quote. Well, coming from John Yoo, that's not much of a recommendation. I'm not going to list his concerns, but you can find those by going online. But for those who with legitimate complaints about the actions and statements of President Trump, and there are many, having John Yoo as an ally is not something you should feel comfortable about. One thing the New York Times has not written about is a growing bromance between Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which has been publicized in the Israeli press but censored by the U.S. media, no doubt because the American public would have as hard a time understanding how the leader of our great Middle Eastern ally is in bed politically with America's number one enemy, as those who demonize Putin while worshiping Netanyahu would have explaining it. Well, let's give credit where credit is due. Netanyahu, or more precisely, the organizations of the Israel lobby that act in his and Israel's behalf, don't want Americans to know about the Netanyahu-Putin bromance, and so the U.S. media doesn't tell them. On February 15th, a week from today, Trump is scheduled to get together with Netanyahu for their first meeting since he won the White House, a victory that Netanyahu eagerly applauded. Trump, like other presidential candidates before him, promised to move the U.S. embassy from Jerusalem, which Israel alone considers its capital. But unlike his predecessors, who for political reasons backed off, he seems likely to do it, although not as quickly as anticipated. From all the preliminaries, including the appointment of his lawyer David Friedman, a supporter and funder of the settlers who maintains a home in Jerusalem, to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel, and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, an Orthodox Jew and also a funder of the settlers and other hardline Israeli causes, as his emissary to deal with the Palestinians, the path seems to be set for another bromance. Trump, like Putin, already did Netanyahu a favor before he took office by phoning Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, asking him to withdraw the resolution to the UN Security Council condemning Israel's settlements as a violation of international law. The resolution was then picked up by New Zealand and pushed through the Security Council by a 14-0 vote, despite the effort of Russia's UN ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, acting on Putin's orders to get the vote postponed. Oh, you only heard that on this program, the only mention in the U.S. media. Obama's decision to have the U.S. allow the resolution to pass by having its ambassador, Samantha Power, abstain rather than vetoing it, brought the wrath of the Israeli-occupied Congress down on his head, and Trump promised nothing would happen like that with him in the White House. Not only do I see another bromance in Trump's future, but throw in Putin, and now we see the world's strangest menage a trois. Early statements by Trump and his criticism of Obama were taken by the ultra-right that dominates the Israeli Knesset as a green light to further expand Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Thus, on Monday, as the Times of Israel reported, and quote, following months of coalition wrangling, damning criticism from internal and international opposition, and bleak warnings from legal experts, by a 60-52 vote, Israel legalized all West Bank outposts with sweeping legislation that aims to prevent future demolitions of settler homes built on private Palestinian land, end quote. The Palestinian land, of course, had been stolen, as was most of what was once Palestine going back to 1948. In a late-night session, the Times of Israel noted, the Knesset passed the final readings of the controversial so-called regulation bill, which paves the way for Israel to recognize some 4,000 illegally built settler homes. The legislation still must be approved by Israel's Supreme Court. All opposition Knesset members present voted against the bill, with veteran Likud member Benny Begin the only coalition member to oppose the measure. Begin is the son of the late former Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, who is a leading proponent of building Jewish settlements. Before the founding of the state, the senior Begin headed the Zionist terrorist group, Irgun, which was responsible for the massacre of the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin outside of Jerusalem in April 1948, and the blowing up of the King David Hotel, which housed the British headquarters in Jerusalem 2 years earlier. Last week, according to Haaretz, Palestinian Authority officials were warned by the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, now operating at Trump's orders, that if they appeal to the International Criminal Court in The Hague about new settlements that have been approved by the Israeli government, they will lose U.S. funding. The warning comes after the Israeli government, in another sign of confidence in Trump, approved 3,000 new residences on the disappearing Palestinian West Bank. Netanyahu announced, moreover, that a new colony will be established there as well. Perhaps it will have its own Trump Tower. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.